Yeah, right. Maybe we should just wait and see whether we hear from Blaisdell.
We were about to. Blaisdell spent a few minutes talking to Carew. The actual download of information from the Jack session would take several hours, patient interrogation under hypnosis, by machine. But he did learn that there were a couple of days unaccounted for between the time Gavrilla was jacked in Guadalajara and her death more than 1,000 miles away. What did she learn that sent her to Portobello? He stayed in the office until he got the coded message from his driver that matters had been disposed of, and then he drove himself home, an eccentricity that sometimes was useful. He lived alone, with robot servants and soldier boy guards, in a mansion on the Potomac, less than a half-hour's drive from the Pentagon, an 18th-century home with original exposed timbers and a wooden floor buckled with age. It was consistent with his image of himself, a man destined from birth, privileged birth, to change the history of the world. And now, his destiny was to end it. He poured his daily ounce of whiskey into a crystal snifter and sat down to the mail. When he turned on the console before the index came up, a blinker told him he had paper mail waiting. Odd. He asked the wheelie to fetch it, and it brought back a single letter, no return address, postmarked from Kansas City that morning. It was interesting, considering the intimacy of some aspects of their relationship, that he didn't recognize Gavrilla's handwriting on the envelope. He read the short message twice, and then burned it. Stanton Roser, the most dangerous man in America? How unlikely, and how convenient. They had a golf date Saturday morning at the Bethesda Country Club. Golf could be a dangerous game. He bypassed his mail and opened up the line to his computer at work. "Good evening, General," it said in a carefully modulated, sexless voice. "List for me every project rated secret or above that has been initiated in the past month. No, 8 weeks. By the Office of Force Management and Personnel. Delete any that have no connection to General Stanton Roser." There were only 3 projects on the list. He was surprised at how little of Roser's work was classified. But one of those projects was essentially a file of miscellaneous classified actions, with 248 entries. He tabled that one and looked at the other 2, separated because they were top secret. They were apparently unrelated, except that both projects had been initiated the same day, and, aha, both were in Panama. One was a pacification experiment on the detainees in a POW camp. The other, a management evaluation scheme at Fort Howell in Portobello. Why hadn't Gavrilla given more details? Damn, the woman's flair for the dramatic. When had she gone to Panama? That was easy enough to check. "Show me all the DARPA travel voucher requests for the past 2 days." Interesting. She had bought a ticket to Portobello under a female code name, and one to the Canal Zone under a male code name. Which flight did she actually take? The note had been on Aeromexico stationery, but that was no help. Both flights used that carrier. Well, which identity had she used in Guadalajara? The computer said that neither code name had flown into the city in the past 2 weeks, but it was a good assumption that she wouldn't have gone through the inconvenience of masquerading as a male while she was tracking down that woman. Therefore, it was likely that she did cross-dress to elude detection on the flight down. Why Panama? Why the Canal Zone? Why the connection with mousy old Stanton? Why didn't she just come back to the States after the damned woman's theory about the Jupiter Project was splashed all over the news? Well, he knew the answer to the last one. Gavrilla watched the news so seldom she probably didn't even know who was president. As if the country had an actual president nowadays. Of course, the Canal Zone could have been a feint. She could get to Portobello from there in minutes. but why would she want to go to either place? Roser was the key. Roser was protecting the scientist by hiding her in one of those two bases.
Give me a list of non-combat deaths of Americans in Panama over the past 24 hours.
All right, there were two at Fort Howell. A male private, who was K-I-L-O-D-N-C, killed in the line of duty, non-combat, and an unidentified female, homicide. Details available, no surprise, on a need-to-know basis from the Office of Force Management and Personnel. He touched the K-I-L-O-D-N-C, which was not restricted, and found that the man had been murdered while standing guard at the Central Administration Building. That must have been Gavrilla's work. A soft chime and a picture of the interrogator, Carew, appeared in the corner of the screen. He touched it, and a 100,000-word hypertext report appeared. He sighed and decided to have a second ounce of whiskey in coffee. We were going to be a little crowded in Building 31. The people in Guadalajara were too vulnerable. There was no telling how many nutcases like Gavrilla might be available to Blaisdell. So our administrative experiment suddenly needed a couple of dozen civilian consultants, the Saturday night special crowd, and the 20. Alvarez stayed behind with the nanoforge, but everybody else got away within 24 hours. I wasn't sure it was a good idea. After all, Gavrilla had killed almost as many people here as she had in Guadalajara. But the guards were really on guard now. Three soldier boys patrolling instead of one. It did simplify the humanization schedule. We had been set up to use the 20 one at a time, by way of the secure phone line at the Guadalajara clinic. Once they were physically inside Building 31, we could use them four at a time, in rotation. I wasn't looking forward to the 20 arriving so much as I was the others, my old friends, who now shared with me an inability to read minds. Everybody who was jacked was completely caught up in this huge project, in which Amelia and I were reduced to the status of retarded helpers. It was good to be around people with a few ordinary non-cosmic problems, people who had time for my own ordinary problems, like becoming a murderer for a second time. No matter how much she deserved it and had brought it on herself, it was still my finger on the trigger, my head full of the indelible image of her last horrifying moments. I didn't want to bring it up with Amelia. Not now. Maybe not for a long time. Reza and I were sitting out on the lawn at night, trying to pick out a few stars hidden in the glare and haze from the city. "It couldn't possibly have bothered you as much as the boy," he said. "If anybody ever had it coming to them, she did." "Oh, hell," I said, and opened a second beer. At a visceral level, it doesn't make any difference who they were or what they did. The kid just got a red spot on his chest and fell over dead. Gavrilla, I sprayed her guts and brains and fucking arms all over the corridor.
"And you keep thinking about it?"
"Can't help it." The beer was still cool. "Every time my stomach growls or I get a little pain down there, I can see her bursting open, knowing I have the same stuff inside."
"But it's not as if you've never seen it before."
"Never caused seeing it before. Big difference." There was an awkward silence. Reza ran a fingertip around the rim of his wine glass, but it just hissed.
"So, are you going to try it again?"
I almost said, "Try what again?" But Reza knew me better than that. "I don't think so. Whoever knows? Until you die of something else, you can always kill yourself."
"Hey, I never thought of it quite that way, thanks."
"Thought you needed cheering up."
"Yeah, right."
He licked his finger and tried the glass again with no result.
"Hey, is this an army-issue wine glass? How you guys expect to win a war without decent glassware?"
"We learned to rough it." So are you taking medicine?
Antidepressants, yeah. I don't think I'm going to do it.
I was startled to realize I hadn't thought about suicide all day until Reza brought it up.
Things have to get better.
I spilled my beer, hitting the dirt. Then the sound registered with Reza, machine gun fire, and he joined me on the ground.
The Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency does not have any combat troops, but Blaisdell was a major general, and among his secret co-religionists was Philip Kramer, the Vice President of the United States. Kramer's primacy on the National Security Council, especially in light of the absence of oversight from the most feckless president since Andrew Johnson, allowed him to grant Blaisdell authority for two outrageous actions. One was the temporary military occupation of the Jet Propulsion Laboratories in Pasadena, essentially preventing anybody from pushing the button that would end the Jupiter project. The other was an expeditionary force under his control in Panama, a country with which the United States was not at war. While the senators and justices blustered and postured over these two blatantly illegal actions, the soldiers involved locked and loaded and went forth to follow orders. The JPL action was trivially easy. A convoy pulled up at 3 a.m. and chased out all the night workers, and then locked the place up tight. Lawyers rejoiced, as did America's persistent anti-military minority. Some scientists felt the celebration was premature. If the soldiers stayed in place for a couple of weeks, constitutional issues would become irrelevant. Attacking an actual army base was not so simple. A brigadier general filed a battle order and died seconds later, personally disposed of by General Blaisdell. It sent a hunter-killer platoon, along with a support company, on a short hop from Cologne to Portobello, supposedly to put down an insurrection by traitorous American troops. For security reasons, they, of course, were forbidden to contact the Portobello base, and they knew very little other than the fact that the insurrection was limited to the Central Command building. They were to take control of it and await orders. The major in charge sent back a query as to why, if the insurrection was so limited, they hadn't given the assignment to a company that was already on the base. There was no answer, the general being dead, so the major had to assume that all of the base was potentially hostile. The map showed that Building 31 was conveniently close to the water, so he improvised an amphibious attack. The soldier boys waded into the water at a deserted beach north of the base and walked underwater for a few miles. Moving through water so close to the shore, they eluded submarine defenses, a deficiency the major recorded for his eventual report. I could hardly believe what I was seeing. Soldier boy versus soldier boy. Two of the machines had come up out of the water and were crouching on the beach, blasting away at two of the guard soldier boys. The other guard machine was hanging back around the corner of the building, ready to join in, but keeping an eye on the front. Nobody had noticed us, evidently. I shook Reza's shoulder to get his attention. He was transfixed by the pyrotechnics of the duel, and whispered, "Stay down, follow me." We low-crawled to a line of shrubs, and then ran crouched over to the building's front door. The shoe guard down by the gate saw us and fired a warning shot, or a badly aimed one, over our heads. I yelled, "Arrowhead!" at him, the day's password, and it evidently worked. He shouldn't have been looking in our direction anyway, but I could lecture him on that some other time. We piled through the narrow door together like a pair of slapstick comics and confronted a blind soldier boy, the one Gavrilla had damaged. We hadn't sent it out for repair because we didn't want to answer questions, and four soldier boys seemed like plenty before we found ourselves in the middle of a war. "Password!" somebody yelled. I said, "Arrowhead!" and Reza helpfully said, "Arrowsmith!" A movie I missed. Close enough, though.